This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, November 20th, 2013. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, They Can't Take It Away. Occasionally on Poetry Off the Shelf, we invite poets to read a few poems of their own choosing to reflect the season and their mood. Brad Lighthouser is a poet, novelist, essayist, translator, teacher, a literary lionish type who is interested in everything from entomology to the American songbook. Brad, we asked you to choose a couple of poems from our website that in one way or another reflect Thanksgiving. And I must say, I was surprised by the choices you made. The first one is A Moment by Mary Elizabeth Coleridge. Tell us about that poem and why you chose it.
I began the search for Thanksgiving poems in a fairly conventional or predictable way, looking for things about richness and harvest and all the rest. And the more I thought about it, I thought that my real subject was gratitude or thankfulness. And in the back of my mind, as I was looking for these poems, I was thinking of one of my favorite songs in the world, the Gershwin Brothers, They Can't Take That Away From Me.
The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that. No, no, they can't take that away from me.
And the notion of whatever you do, it doesn't matter. The memory is somehow eternal, and that's the thing we're grateful for. So anyway, my search was in my own mind, was called They Can't Take That Away From Me. Looking with that in mind, I chose this poem, as you say, by Mary Elizabeth Coleridge, who was a great-grandniece of Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
And, yeah, I have it written down, a great-great-grandniece of Samuel Taylor Coleridge.
Okay, even better. And,
yeah.
But anyway, however slight the connection, she was a novelist and a poet, probably today better known as a poet. And one of the reasons why I liked it, it's about somebody glancing at the poet. It's somebody who clearly matters deeply, I think romantically, to the poet. And really, the more I thought about it, I thought really that's all we need to know.
Well, let's hear it before we talk about it any further. It's very brief. Go ahead and give it a read.
Okay. A moment. The clouds had made a crimson crown above the mountains high. The stormy sun was going down in a stormy sky. Why did you let your eyes so rest on me and hold your breath between? In all the ages, this can never be as if it had not been.
Now, the poem begins fairly conventionally, especially for a 19th century poem, describing a dramatic sunset. The clouds had made a crimson crown above the mountains high. The stormy sun was going down in a stormy sky. And then it switches to this moment where somebody looking at the speaker in the poem is strangely moved. Why did you let your eyes so rest on me and hold your breath between? So what's the connection between the first stanza and the landscape and the sunset and the second stanza of this moment?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think you're right. It's a very conventional, almost too much so, arguably, that first stanza. And, you know, you have that inverted word order, very old-fashioned, the mountains high rather than the high mountains.
Mm. But I
think the interesting word in that first stanza, and really the only word that comes at me a little unexpectedly, is stormy. You know, we have stormy clouds typically, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, you don't usually have a stormy sun. You know, the sun is constant and, you know, weather is what goes around underneath the sun. But suggesting, and I may be reading too much in the poem, but it's one of the reasons why I take the you here to be masculine and to be somewhat kind of dashing almost.
Smoldering even.
Yeah, I mean, smolder, and that sense. I mean, it's got a touch to me of a kind of Heathcliff. You know, it's we're in the world here of Wuthering Heights or Jane Eyre, and most of that coming from that stormy sun. And here you get a feeling of violence and passion in this scene of celestial violence, if you will. In that moment, we're suddenly asking about motivation. You know, why did you let your eyes so rest on me? Not, you know, and in that moment, your eyes, you know, rested on me or something like that. It's the single moment of reaching out. Did you feel what I felt? Why did you let your eyes so rest on me and hold your breath? And the poem is taking place effectively in the space of one breath, you know, one breath of the, you know, thousands and millions of breaths a person breathes in his or her life. And yet, this is the breath that matters. These are the pulse beats, you know, when all the other pulse beats fade from memory that last.
Let's talk about the last two lines, because they're a complicated double negative.
Mm-hmm.
In all the ages, this can never be as if it had not been. Basically, she's saying this happened.
Yes.
But why the double negatives?
Yeah, I think that's...
which are beautiful, by the way.
You've focused on exactly what interests me. I mean, it's a little eight-line poem, and all the poetry is really in lines 7 and 8. If, you know, lines 1 and 6 are merely the taxi that's going to, you know, to bring you to the dwarf. And that's what happens, I think, with those final two lines. It's an oddly positive, to speak paradoxically, in its double negativeness, it's an oddly positive remark. It's saying that however much you may doubt or however much you may want to disclaim it, there was a moment when our two souls connected, and that's what matters in this world, and that's what matters in this life, and nothing you're going to do subsequently can undo that moment.
Now, your second choice also surprised me. It's by Witter Binner, and it's called He Brought Us Clover Leaves. I know of Witter Binner as a translator from the Chinese.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
But tell us just a little bit about him as a poet.
Well, he lived much of his life out in New Mexico.
D.H. Lawrence and people like that.
Yeah, but he was a conventional poet in many ways and wasn't terribly comfortable, I think, with the whole modernist revolution. The poem I've chosen is him in his very competent, conventional mode. And he's a poet I chose two poets who I thought I was hoping were somewhat obscure and partly in the hope to lead readers toward them. And so anyway, those were some of my thoughts as I chose a Witter Binner poem.
Okay, let's hear it. Here's He Brought Us Clover Leaves by Witter Binner.
He picked us clover leaves and starry grass and buttercups and chickweed. One by one, smiling, he brought them. We can never pass a roadside or a hill under the sun where his wee flowers will not return with him. His little weeds and grasses, cups that brim with sunbeams, leaves grown tender in the dew. Come then, oh come with us. And each in turn, children and elders, let us thread a few of all the daisies to enfold his urn and fade beside this day through which he passes, bringing us clover leaves and starry grasses.
The first question that pops to mind is, who is he in the poem? He brought clover leaves, but he's also dead, as we learn from the urn, the mention of the urn. Who is he?
Well, it's very vague, and I somehow have settled on a kind of white-haired uncle. But, you know, that's my own. With things this short, part of the appeal for the reader is that you're constantly needing to kind of supplement and ornament. One of the things I like about the poem is that his taste is for the modest. Whoever he is, they're little tiny flowers. They're little tiny things. These clover leaves they're nice things. There's nothing extraordinary about them. The grasses, the buttercups are mild. These are all moderate gifts.
It's almost childlike. It's almost something a child would bring you.
Yes, it is almost childlike. And we don't see him, although we know that he has become part of the roadside. He's become a part of, as we travel around, and puzzlingly for a moment, is that kind of urge to action, you know, come. Come where? Come who? Who are you talking to? You know, it just for a moment we're puzzled. Come then, oh, come with us. Who are the us? I think the poem here is clearly a poem about gratitude and feeling that we must thank him in return. He was always giving us these little modest, lovely gifts, and now he's dead, and we are going to show our gratitude by decorating the urn and by symbolically paying homage to him.
You know, it's funny. You thought of he as being a gray-haired uncle. I actually thought of him as being a child who died.
Indeed, perhaps literally a child. Perhaps someone who's older but has kept that childish, in the good sense, you know, childish simplicity. In any case, what we do know of the deceased is that come with us, and each in turn, children and elders, in other words, those who appreciate him extend across the generations.
You know, maybe it's the season, and we're at the end of fall, we're approaching Thanksgiving. But there's also, seems to me, this poem has a lot of metaphorical freight to it. And the he could be something much larger than just a person. It could be the procreative spirit within nature itself.
Absolutely. And you know, it's interesting because even when we come to pay him tribute, you know, let's bring the flowers out. The flowers are fading. Our gift itself is fading. And I feel very much the poem has that autumnal feeling. You don't feel you're not in winter. You're very aware here of the passing of the flowers, the passing of life. We're going to bring out the flowers that fade beside this day through which he passes. Interestingly, he passes on, I suppose, but what's in the present tense? His gift continues on beside this day through which he passes, bringing us clover leaves and starry grasses.
So you chose two poems of gratitude, or that you identify with gratitude, and but they both are tainted by a potential sadness. In the first poem, there's the potential sadness of unrequited love, that this was a moment and something. And here we have the sadness of somebody or something's death. So what's the relationship between gratitude and I guess, death? What is the...
Well, yeah, as I say, when I first started looking, I thought I would find the poem that is celebrating the harvest, and that's the underlying notion, you know, behind Thanksgiving. But in a way, what struck me as the more moving is not let's be grateful for the full table, the groaning board, the feast. The gratitude that's in a way more poignant and interesting is the one that has to acknowledge or deal with loss and still says just as insistently, we give thanks. That I myself am determined, in the first poem, I myself am determined. In the second poem, we collectively are determined to be grateful for that gift of life, for that gift of communication, for that gift of communion, for all the things that are the richest aspects of our existence, and doing so in the face of a certain amount of loss. Both poems have intimations of loss and sadness. You don't feel overwhelming, you know, that these are heartbroken poems by any means. On the other hand, they are acknowledging loss in the midst of warmth and gratitude.
Brad, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Brad Lighthizer's latest book is The Oldest Word for Dawn, New and Selected Poems. You can subscribe to this podcast and the Poetry Magazine podcast in the iTunes store, or you can stream them straight from our site, poetryfoundation.org. If you have any comments on this program, email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.
We may never, 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 never meet again on the bumpy road to love.
Swing it along.
Still I'll always, always keep the memory of the way you hold tonight. The way we dance till three.
Oh, yes. The way you change my life. No, no, they can't take that away from me.
No, they can't take that away from me.
Will you repeat that again, dearie, please?
No, they can't take that away from me.